Wow.
Exactly.
So my 10 meg JSONs, that's a no-go with AIDEAL integrations.
Not going to work.
Dang.
From the Spec Network, this is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show. Okay, Kaushik, here we are again, man. How you doing?
I am doing good, sir. How are you?
I'm doing really good. I'm pretty excited about today's topic.
Yeah.
Something that I have dabbled with a couple of clients, and but not at the capacity of the gentleman that we have on today's show.
Oh, yeah. This gentleman is perhaps known for having a sound understanding of the subject.
Definitely. So let's go ahead and introduce him first before we really dive into the topic. We'd like to welcome Ty Smith to the show. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for coming on the show.
Of course.
For the folks that haven't been introduced to you or not familiar with you in general, could you kind of give a little bit of background information about yourself, you know, who you are, where you work, where you maybe have worked before, because you have quite the impressive background in Android. So learning a little bit about you and kind of the background of you and where you're at now would be a great help.
Sure. So guys, my name's Ty Smith, and I'm currently an Android engineer at Uber. I tech lead the mobile platform for the external API, which is our group that really focuses on external partners and how they integrate with the Uber platform. I've been doing developer platform related companies for quite a while within the Android space. And before that, I was just kind of doing pure product Android development. The very first app I did was actually a pretty funny story. I was working at this small consultant company, and I was a Ruby on Rails developer.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I was just, you know, going along my merry way, not worried about this really hard world of mobile. I wasn't worried about fragmentation or anything else.
No concurrency, threading, no main threads. Yeah, yeah.
no semicolons.
Ruby, yeah, I know.
Ruby was nice. And my boss came to me, the founder of the company, one day, and he said, "Hey, so we've got this pretty large client that you guys may have heard of, Zagat. They were a restaurant review company based out of New York.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You might see the Zagat ratings at a bunch of companies. They were they were purchased by Google years after I worked on the project." But he said, "Hey, so we'd secured this project. We were subcontracting and working on the Zagat app, and we had found this Android contractor that, you know, this was 2009, so Android was pretty fresh. Like I think I was working on 1.6 with like a G1 or maybe the device right after that. It was nice. Pretty young in its time." And he said, "Yes, we had this contractor, and due to some issues, he's going to have to step off the project." And this was 2 or 3 weeks in. "And we have a really tight timeline." I think it was something like 3 or 4 months. And he was like, "How do you feel about learning Android and shipping the first version of this in that time?" I thought, and I think I said something to the effect of, "Well, I don't think you're really asking my opinion." And he's like, "Well, you know, that's the state of the world." So,
easy peasy. That's basically the response. Yeah, no sweat.
Dove right in and worked on that. I don't think we made it on time, but it went out and it was fine. It was great. And I stuck around there for a little bit, worked on a few other small contracting apps. And then I ended up hopping over to the company that had contracted us for Zagat. It was called Handmark at the time. They ended up splitting into another company called One Louder Apps, which you guys may have heard from some of your other guests. Chris Baines worked on a Facebook app called Flow that they purchased, and it became Friendcaster.
Oh.
And so I worked with them, and I worked on Zagat directly there for a little while, and then I worked on Sprint's an app for Sprint. They were a big partner with Sprint to do their SMS and MMS and group messaging, so I built that out. And that was this small little company out of Texas. And it was kind of amusing because a few names that are pretty well-known in the Android community, worked there with me at the time. So Chris Baines, his app was bought, and he helped out a little bit there as a contractor. Chris Arvin, who did Bacon Reader, and went to Expedia with Dan Liu, he did Bacon Reader, which they bought. Juan Gomez, who now is at Netflix, he came in there right as I was leaving to take over the project I was on. Matt Ware, another guy in the community who was at Evernote, and I believe he's now at HomeAway, he was also there. So it was this tiny little Dallas-based consulting company who had a few of the Android community folks kind of float through.
Wow, like an Android all-star crew there.
Yeah, it was interesting. After a year or so there, I decided to move out of Texas and into the Bay Area, and that's when I got my first taste of kind of Silicon Valley life when I joined Evernote.
Oh yeah,
to do Android work, and started as kind of just normal product work, doing different features, design related stuff. I was there when we did the redesign into Holo, which was interesting.
Wow.
Good old Holo.
That was a fun project. And I started working a lot on like partner integrations for like BD and different specific partners that we would work with. And I started working with the developer relations folks and started really developing this passion project for interacting with external developers and for these integrations and seeing how Android could really become a platform there. And so after that, I was like, wow, I really love this like developer advocacy and Android engineering as a platform kind of perspective. And after I was there a couple of years, I moved over to Twitter and I worked on Fabric, which I'm sure most of the guests will be familiar with.
Oh yeah.
It was a very small team right after the acquisition of Crashlytics. And worked pretty heavily and saw that move from a single SDK to a suite of SDKs. And now finally I'm at Uber and working on building this new developer platform and really trying to make Uber a platform and build out strong use cases that people want to integrate with. It's pretty interesting.
If you had to explain what a developer platform is to someone who's just getting into Android development, what would a developer platform be, and why would someone want to use it?
So I think there's a few different elements of a developer platform. There's the backend side, there's all the APIs and the docs and everything else that you might expect to be able to interact with. But you have these different companies that view developer platforms in slightly different ways. You have the companies who are building tooling, and that's kind of their primary value. Companies like Optimizely and Leanplum, who BuddyBuild, you know, these different Crashlytics, even before they were acquired by Twitter, whose primary job is selling an SDK or an API or some sort of developer tool to their audience.
Okay.
And for those companies, their developer platform, their developer tooling is their lifeblood. But then you have other companies like Twitter, like Facebook, like Dropbox, who see the developer platform as a way to start to extend their outside of their core competencies and build up power users who have multiple integrations, who they try to, you know, engage new apps to build in and create a stronger platform that has higher retention. And you kind of have these two different perspectives. And the bigger companies, which I've been working at more recently, view it as just kind of a one other area to acquire users and then provide value to those users. But some of the other companies I've invested in and do some advising on companies, they focus more explicitly on the developer platform as a tool that's directly served to their customer that they try to make revenue on or is their core competency.
You summed it up really well. So essentially, there are two aspects to it, right? Like there are companies who essentially want to expose the service that they provide. For example, Uber, for that matter, right? It's the service of using Uber where you expose that as a platform. And then there are companies that basically provide you the tooling as like very specifically for like developer tooling, they provide you a product.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right. So actually developer platforms encompasses, like you said, a BD support, that's one thing. And then there's the whole SDK, any integration that needs to be done on the backend. Essentially, I guess whenever a company has an API that's consumable from the outside, that's when like they start to like up their game on the developer platform scene, I suppose.
It depends on the company. I mean, Twitter for a long time just had an API, a RESTful API that people were hitting. And
it wasn't until
after the acquisition of Crashlytics that they started building out, you know, multiple teams that were focused on how do you bring developer happiness and a good development experience to mobile developers as well as potentially server developers.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good distinction, right?
It definitely went through its ups and downs, but the main third-party library for consuming that, Twitter for J, was completely community developed. It wasn't until Fabric that they started bringing some of that in-house and saying, how do we own this piece of the platform?
Gotcha.
Cool. So now we have a lot of folks on this that listen to the show that are in teams that are possibly building or wanting to build some type of, you know, developer platform, or even just in general, an SDK that they can ship to other users. And I know that you've worked on some things at some of the various companies you've worked at and built some of these things. I'd like to hop in and start discussing what would be the best way for folks to start building, you know, consumable SDKs for different developers and different teams. And the reason why I want to talk about it right now is I actually have some experience, a small bit of experience doing this for previous clients. And we had built some stuff in with AIDL services and content providers and all kinds of different stuff to expose different data. But I was wondering if you had some certain thoughts on what would be probably the top thing that you would consider the most important when you're starting to ship and build these SDKs. Is it like stability? Is it that your API is consistent? Is it the visibility of your packages? Is it testing it? Is it how you're hosting it? What, you know, let's hop into that a little bit. What do you think is probably some of the most important qualities?
Absolutely. So I think that stability is probably your number one. This is incredibly important for probably a few reasons that let me just start digging into these. One is when you roll out an SDK, you're rolling out this binary to a hosted location. Say you're on Maven Central or JSON, or people are consuming these. Maybe you're even just putting out the source code on GitHub. You don't even have your binary, but you put this out in a stale state, and you're like, okay, I have this SDK that my customers should consume and start using. Now, if I'm an app developer and I push out a crashy update, I can notice that. I can check Crashlytics or Bugsnag. I can see that I have some bugs. I can get user reports. I can potentially roll out another fix pretty quickly and get that out. Now, when you roll out an SDK that has issues, your developers that are consuming that aren't thinking about your SDK past the point that they integrate. That's not the business value that they're providing. They just wanted to include that so that they could get some analytics, or they just wanted to include that so that they could load an image or do some dependency injection or whatever is the use case that drove them to do that. But once they've put it in, with very few exceptions, they're not actively thinking about that, watching the new releases that you're putting out, seeing the communication that you're trying to drive to your community. So if you put out an SDK that is crashing, one that's a horrible experience for the consumers of the application of your customers being the developer, because your developers, this application may be their lifeblood, right? They may be some indie developer who's making their income off of this. Yeah. And now you're causing a poor experience to their users.
Right, right. And it isn't just even indie developers, right? Like even if you work at a medium-sized company like I do, if I find that an SDK or a library that I use crashes, immediately I've lost all faith. Because the thing is,
Absolutely. The
whole idea is we want to save our time. We don't want to actually build this thing on our own, which typically most engineers love doing. The only reason is so that you don't have to deal with that problem. And the minute your library starts crashing, it becomes your problem, right? And that is like a big no-no.
And it's like a black box too.
Depending on if it's open source or not, absolutely. But one of the bigger problems with that is once it's crashing and once you push that out, what if it's not as clear as a crash? What if it's what if it's your SDK needs to talk to a web service and you're improperly using the alarm manager or the job scheduler or something like that, and you start DDoSing your own web service? Now, you have to try to communicate out to the different implementers of your SDK that, hey, you guys are seeing a lot of users, and because you're seeing a lot of users, we're getting a lot of traffic on our SDK, but we had a bug in our SDK, so you need to put out another update.
Oh, yeah, they just...
that can be a terrible relationship to have with your developer. And even once you put out that update, it may be weeks before they see that there's an update. It may be months before that they see there's an update. And then if they're not on a regular build train, it may be months more before that's out in the wild. So if you put out a crashy update, that might be out in the wild for months.
Just thinking about it sends shivers up my spine.
Mm-hmm. And to you know, what that makes you do is that makes you think about really strong engineering rigor, testing, quality of your APIs, dog fooding it, really getting strong user feedback. It instills a lot of the other qualities that you think about when you're building SDKs, I think.
I had two quick follow-up questions. So does that mean then if you are building essentially an SDK or like you work on developer platforms, does that mean that you cannot afford to have the luxury of moving as fast as typically most startups do? Because for example, if you're building a front-end consumer product, right? The intention with most startups is typically to like accelerate at neck-breaking paces, right?
Sure.
And sometimes you understand the trade-off of like, yeah, sure, if like we move fast and like we release a feature, then sure, like sometimes there might be crashes and like we're willing to accept the pain that's associated with a user's sort of facing that crash, right? That isn't necessarily a luxury you get as a library or an SDK maintainer, right? So does that mean it intentionally slows down your pace, or do you try to adjust that by making sure that you have more tests? Do you make testing easier? That was like the first part of my question.
Sure. I think it requires a different mentality, honestly. So I believe you can still move quickly while testing. I believe that if you are thorough in your architecture and you hire the right quality of engineers, that it is possible to create testable code in a well-architected and separated way that you can have confidence in so that you sleep at night even when you're on call while moving at startup speed. I gave a satirical talk on this at Square, I think, last year. It was called, I don't remember the name. It was like too fast to test or something like that. It was just a talk about what are the other qualities that you want to think about? What kind of qualities does having to test your code make you think about? And once you get into the mindset of well-separated concern, of proper interfaces, of modular code, of more maintainable code, it actually becomes somewhat challenging to go back to thinking about it with like coupled spaghetti code.
Right.
So it actually, in my mind, it's made me a much better engineer thinking about systems in this way. And maybe you can't move quite as fast as someone who's just constantly pumping out features. But in the end, they're thinking about different product requirements than you are. They're retaining users by having new features to compete against their competitors. You're retaining your developer users by building developer trust, by building ease of integration, by building up a developer community.
That makes sense. The other quick question that I had was you mentioned that, okay, as a developer, like if you face crashes, we use something like Crashlytics to see like what our crash metrics are, right? I was curious, if you develop an SDK and you discover a crash happening, how do you folks monitor that on the other side of the equation, right? For example, if my app is crashing, I use Crashlytics, but do you also use Crashlytics inside your SDK?
I think there's not one straightforward answer to that question. I think it's difficult. And I think in general, putting analytics in an open source SDK could be viewed pretty negatively.
Yeah, so, for sure. Yeah.
You know, one of the conversations that I had at Twitter when we were putting out the Twitter like single sign-on SDK and the embedded tweets and all of that was how do we record impressions and the different things that from a business value are cared about, but a developer may not necessarily want this open source library that they're including to be persisting down analytic events to disk, sending those up. So I think it's a balance to be had. You have to be clear with your developer community what you're tracking, why you're tracking it, so that they have trust in the transparency that you're providing. But then when it comes specifically to crashing, that's pretty difficult as well, because you know when a Java crash happens, the uncaught exception handler is thrown. It's kind of just a global system that's going to be handling it at that point. So when it's something like Crashlytics, that makes it pretty easy for them to see, hey, we had a crash in Crashlytics, or we had a crash in your code, and they can know where to funnel that stack trace down such that the SDK can get information on being crashing, or the developer app can. But that is a unique case where the platform owner sees that. When you're something like the Evernote SDK or the Uber SDK, it becomes a lot more challenging. You have to rely a lot more on the communication from your developers where they see the crashes going on. I can imagine some scenarios where you would do things like install your own uncaught exception handler and then wrap their uncaught exception handler. But that's, in my mind, there's a lot of edge cases that could come along with that. You know, you could have conflicts, you could be dual reporting, you could prevent their crashes from going up. So
yeah, exactly.
I'm not saying you shouldn't, and I'm sure some companies have figured out how to do that the right way. But I think that relying on the communication from your developer community is paramount.
Naming is one of the hardest things in software, it seems. There's a lot of, you know, arguments about, oh, what should I name things? In your experience, did you come across any tricks or any tips of how to accurately name something? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it becomes a little more of a complex problem when you're dealing with SDKs or libraries than when you're managing your own project, because it can be a really big problem when you put out an API in one version and then you said, oh, I have a better name for that. Let's change that in the next version. And all of a sudden you break the consumers of that when they auto update.
Yeah.
So once you put a name out, you're kind of stuck with it unless you want to deprecate that. And so that I often think that just having a better name is not a very good reason to deprecate a method. So creating some guidelines up front on how you want to name your callbacks, how you want to engage with your methods, how you, you know, even keeping, if you have multiple platforms, iOS and Android, keeping some consistency in those so that you have a general environment that people become familiar with, I think becomes pretty important. There's a funny saying that if people have seen me talk before, I like to throw around, and I don't know where I originally heard it, but it's an API is like a baby. They're fun to make, but you have to support them for 18 years.
Yeah, that is so true. Yeah, breaking APIs can also be a big problem, right? Like a simple method change essentially translates into like a breaking API, right?
So yeah, adding new parameters, removing them, changing the name. So when you put something out there, you often are stuck with that for a little bit. So coming up with the name originally, you don't always have the best name. And sometimes you just kind of have to suck it up and move on. But having some guidelines to how you want to build that out and having consistency between those is going to be a much better experience than frequently trying to iteratively choose the best possible name.
And I imagine things like semantic versioning, where you're like good about adhering to those standards, also help people understand like, hey, if it's a 1.0 to a 2.0, something's broken. I mean, at least like that, the expectation is that some API is broken. So there's some level of effort involved in changing or like adapting your code, right?
It's true. But in practice, I find that very idealistic. I mean, I try to stick with semantic versioning just like everyone else, but I see projects all over the place. Very well-known projects that'll do breaking API updates in minor version updates or patch updates, or users.
Wow.
That, or especially having this broad range of users, you know, not all developers understand that when you move from a 1.0 to a 2.0, that implies that it's broken. So having this broad range of kind of shotgun communication where you're updating your changelog, where you're sending out communication to the consumers of your SDK, where you're maybe talking about it on Twitter or the other channels that you frequently use for engaging with them, I think you kind of have to take a shotgun approach to try to get that information out there. And you're still going to run into people that have problems with it.
You touched offhand about hosting in Maven, Maven Central, and you said like if it's open source, then it's probably GitHub. How about, could you tell us like some of the options you would have as like someone who maintains an SDK? But what are my different options to host an SDK, and in your experience, which has been certain options that have worked pretty well?
Sure. I think that there's a couple different binaries that are pretty prevalent in the Android and Java ecosystem. And they kind of... So one of those is just the standard jar, and the other of those is the AAR. We also had the apklib, which was kind of an older format when more people were using Maven, and that was kind of a community-inspired one, but that's not really prominent these days. The AAR is going to be more useful if you're doing any sort of resource or view related work, whereas the jar is probably just fine if you're doing just like pure Java stuff. Depending on how you're wanting to set up your Gradle builds to generate your SDK, AR is probably simpler if you actually want to reference Android classes. Otherwise, you have to try to do like source linking, then build a Java project if you want to build a jar that still references contexts or activities or other things like that. But once you have your binary, there's kind of a few different options, like you said. Maven Central and JCenter are two pretty prevalent ones, but they both require you to have an open source library. So there is no concept of like an end user license agreement acceptance or terms of service acceptance. You just kind of, as a consumer, you just put in the Gradle dependency or the Maven dependency or the Ivy dependency, and that's consumed. And so there's an implicit acceptance of the terms of service. Therefore, those hosting providers require that anything uploaded to them that is available in the default repos are open source. So if you're open source, it's not too bad. You can kind of put it in Maven Central or in JCenter. I find JCenter has it's slightly easier to work with. They have some better plugins. The Gradle plugins, I believe, are now hosted out of JCenter as well. It's kind of a superset of Maven Central and some others. But Maven Central, it's a little bit more traditional, a little older. There's still a lot of tooling that references that directly, and you have to additionally add in JCenter. So I don't have a strong suggestion on one or the other. But if you're not an open source SDK, then it becomes more problematic because you have to host your own Artifactory repo, or I guess you have to host your own repo, and that could commonly be used by Artifactory. If you want to host that yourself, I've seen companies that just throw up an S3 repo with the Maven structure on that. But it becomes more of a headache.
And in fact, like one of the options that we have used, and obviously this wouldn't necessarily work with large commercial sort of applications, but Jitpack, which is something Don suggested some time back to me, like works perfectly well. They take they alleviate a lot of like the sort of boilerplate and like the nasty setup that's required to like host your stuff on Maven Central or even JCenter. But obviously that isn't something, Jitpack is not necessarily like a standard, and it's like a private, it's privately owned. So something to like just weigh in and think about.
It's true. And I've consumed a few things from Jitpack. I've never hosted anything on Jitpack, but it's pulling it from GitHub. And I've heard stories of GitHub getting onto people that are using GitHub as a hosting repository when higher amounts of traffic starts going to that. So that may be better for a small open source library. My intuition is that if you were building a company's developer platform and you started getting some heavy amounts of traffic to that, you might have some representatives at GitHub knocking on your door.
I do think they only pull from GitHub when you have a change and then they cache it, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
I'm not entirely sure of the internals, but well, definitely something to keep in mind.
If that's the case, then that might alleviate that concern that I had, but it's still one of the negatives for the user in that, or in the custom Artifactory route, is that they have to explicitly add the repo, which complicates the build script, and it increases the complexity of the integration, which is something, especially as you're trying to target a broad range of developers, that you want to minimize.
Now, we have talked a little bit about building SDKs and kind of sharing them and kind of the higher level stuff. Let's kind of hop a little bit more into the weeds here and talk about when we want an app, maybe perhaps to talk to another app. And I think one of the primary examples of this is maybe an app that it has some type of single sign-on. Have you ever done anything or built anything that has single sign-on? And if so, what were the main benefits in doing so?
Yeah, I've worked on the Evernote single sign-on, the Twitter single sign-on, and the Uber single sign-on.
Wow.
So
okay.
You can say I have quite a bit of experience with that. And I've contributed both through security reviews and pull requests to Facebook and Dropboxes and a few others as well. So
how does that work? And if you're to build one, what does that kind of look like? If I'm wanting to implement that in my application for, you know, my developer platform, what's the steps and tools and concepts that I need to be aware of to build this?
Sure. So the primary benefit to a third-party developer is to allow their users to authenticate against a third-party app with less overhead. So let's say that you wanted to integrate with the Uber API. Now, you have a couple different options. You include the Uber Android SDK, and you have some wrapped APIs that you want to hit. Maybe you want to get the status of a trip that's in progress. And so you need to get an authentication token such that you can check on the status of that trip for that user. Now, with the Uber app installed, you can navigate the user over to the Uber app. The user is already signed in. They can authorize your third-party application to grant the scopes that are required for the information that you're expecting, and then return the authorization token back to your application such that you can make the API requests on behalf of the user. Now, normally you would want to have some sort of graceful fallback for that, such that if the app was not installed, the user would be able to complete the use case as well. So a great example of this is when the app is installed, you take them to the app and you have an experience for them to authorize the scopes. And when the app is not installed, then you take them to an OAuth web view where they can enter their credentials, where it will still return the authorization token and you can make the API request. Now,
so if you're doing
the second one had more overhead to it. The user had to put in their credentials. Maybe you were using Chrome tabs and they didn't, but that would have expected them to sign in there as well. So that's a little extra complexity.
So in the first use case, that's going to be basically a deep link. Is that correct?
It is. It could be a couple different things. So it can be just a standard URI, which is a deep link, where either you're using a universal deep link, the app may be overwriting a specific HTTP URL that is equivalent to the login for your page, or it could be an explicit scheme for your application. Maybe it's like Uber // and then some content to get over to that. However, it could also be just a standard intent. The SDK could potentially say, let's construct an intent with this package set. Maybe it has a specific action that we want to integrate with. Maybe I create an action called authenticate user, and that's fired and my app is registered to receive that in my manifest. Or I could, if I was the developer of that, I could also use the Android account manager, where they would use they would have to have the extra permissions for get account and manage accounts. But with that in place, then they could use the account manager to authenticate an access token as well. So there's a few different implementation details that could kind of get you to the same experience, but in the end, they kind of all drive the same use case.
Well, that's good. So account manager, deep links, intent APIs, these are mechanisms of doing that. Along the same theme of sort of like sharing data or sharing information across applications, right? There's also the concept of like content providers, and then there's AIDEAL integrations. Now, I know Don also has worked on AIDEAL integration, so you folks would probably understand this better. But could you explain to me, when would I use a content provider and when would I just use an AIDEAL, right? Like, why not just use one? Why do I need like multiple ways of doing what might be the same thing? Obviously, it's not the same thing, but like if you can call out the differences, it'll be helpful for our listeners to sort of understand that.
Absolutely. So the content provider is usually schemed. It's usually styled by a URI, and it's more loosely typed data that you might want to consume with a cursor potentially. So there's use cases where that might be valid. Maybe you're wanting to look at specific types of data that are coming back in a list that you can iterate on a cursor. There are methods on a content provider to stream files, so you can use it to specifically access a file. If you had a URI, a great example of a content provider was when I was working at Evernote, we wanted to implement the action edit and the action view intent in Android for having an attachment in an Evernote note be utilized in a third-party app that could specifically handle the MIME type of that attachment. So let's say that you had a note that had an Office, like a Microsoft Office doc attached to it. And you would you have this doc file, which has a MIME type that's represented there. And when the user engages with that, we launch the action edit intent with that MIME type specified. Now, all of the applications on the device can then say, hey, I'm available to handle that sort of thing. So the user picks one of those, and we construct the intent to send it out. And so we set the data to the URI of that attachment. Now, that URI is going to be provided through the content provider. So we're going to be streaming that file, and we need to grant read or write access to that file temporarily as well, depending on if they had said action view or action edit. Now, where it can get a little hairy is in an integration like that, you see a lot of volatility on the Android platform. So I would see third-party apps that would say they could handle that MIME type. And when you would send the URI over there, they would edit it directly. And then they would call set result and finish. And so that's a pretty straightforward example. You gave them a URI, they edited the URI, and they returned. And you got in a non-activity result, an okay or a canceled or whatever the valid use case was. But we started running into other weird use cases as well, where maybe they would copy the URI. They would write it into a different file as the user edited it in that third-party app. And then when they set the result, they would return back a new data URI. So now you have the original data URI that you provided them and the new data URI that you're consuming from them, which is likely being streamed from their content provider. And that was a use case where they did call set result. But you have another use case where some apps would edit the URI and then call finish without calling set result. And so you wouldn't get a valid okay result, but the URI was changed. The user engaged with it. So we had to set up this weird fallback mechanism where we first, when the user specified interest in editing the file, we copied the file. We then handed a URI out for a temporary file that was a representation of it. The third-party app then, maybe it was like an image editor, they edited the file, and when they returned it, we checked first, was the MD5 of the URI that we sent over the same as the URI that that it is now on the OnResume? If they set result and gave us URI, is that the same URI? Is it changed? If they gave us, if there was no change at all, then that's another use case. And so we started prompting the user based on this data set, hey, do you want to... We got a result back from the app. Do you want to save it? Or no changes or various information like that. Now, different apps behave different ways. Those are all consuming from streaming this file over the content provider, which is one specific use case. To kind of take that a step back outside of the realm of streaming data, streaming files, big data sets that you may want to iterate on for a list with a cursor, the AIDL is more statically typed. So the AIDL explicitly binds a service between their app and your app. And it requires them to have a generated code set based on a common defined interface. But this allows you to transfer objects directly in between. So it's a little more useful for the statically typed type of content, where the content provider has this looser mechanism for kind of defining the data and handing it more based on the URI. You could manipulate both of them to handle very similar use cases. So it just kind of depends what you're thinking about from a maintainability perspective.
Gotcha. The way I think about content providers is it's like more of a placeholder, right? Whereas with AIDL integrations, because it's a service, it allows you to sort of be a little more flexible in the kind of things that you can potentially do, right?
Definitely. I mean, you can have, I believe, any type of parcelable object going across an AIDL directly, but that requires that both consumer and provider of that have the same method definitions and class definitions. So if you have potentially an app that's maybe your app that provides the service has updated and the third-party app consuming the jar that you provide is not updated, then you could have weird versioning issues in the AIDL. You could run into similar problems with the content provider, but those are more loosely typed since you're specifically assembling a URI where you're parsing that out.
I think if you're using AIDL too, there's something to be aware of that's a weird gotcha that you'll never know about until you hit it, and that's the transaction too large exception, meaning that the binder transaction failed because the objects you're trying to send across in parcel are just far too big to handle.
Yep.
The binder transaction buffer has a limited fixed size of 1 megabyte, and that's in the Android documentation, and we can link to that. But that's one of the ones that I ran into. We're sending a humongous amount of data over from an AIDL service, and all of a sudden, one day, it just started breaking because we were sending more data back than binder can handle. So
absolutely,
it's just a weird...
And that's a great use case for where you might want to use a URI with a content provider and stream that out directly.
Yep.
Wow.
Exactly.
So my 10 meg JSONs, that's a no-go with AIDEAL integrations.
Not going to work.
Dang.
So this is good information, you know, sharing data between with content providers and more statically via AIDL. But there's also more ways that we can, you know, share data. And you've touched on a couple of these, and that's going to be through intents. And then I even mentioned deep links. Have you used deep links at all to share data? And if so, what did you do? And if not, do you use deep links at all?
Sure. Actually working on the Uber app, I've been a little more focused on deep links specifically. The Uber SDK today generates a deep link to start the user's trip or to apply promotions or a handful of other use cases that are generated through non-published developer means. Like, for example, maybe a marketing email is sent out to try to re-engage folks. That will often be a deep link that fires back into the app. Now, that's more often than not going to be standard, a universal deep link where it's potentially just a standard URI with query parameters that you're parsing out and reading and then trying to do stuff with. You can do intent APIs over Chrome as of, I think the version like 24 allowed for explicitly defining intent APIs. However, as soon as you're thinking about cross-platform,
exactly,
you're dealing with iOS and Android.
I was going to bring that up, yeah.
Either using a standard native scheme in your deep links or using universal deep links is going to serve you much better, in my opinion.
What is a universal deep link?
A universal deep link is an HTTP URL that has a backing server that understands what type of device is connecting to and can redirect appropriately to either the Play Store, the App Store, or the application such that it can be consumed. You can get into some interesting complexity, like deferred deep linking, where you want to fire over a refer ID to the Play Store. The Play Store then installs the application on behalf of the user. It then emits that refer ID in the install vendor broadcast receiver to your application. You would then catch that, read out that data. You could see the original deep link that the user was trying to engage with, and then you could continue the flow for that user.
Which is just a great user experience.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They click a link, installs the app, and all of a sudden they're on the specific page that they were trying to link into, or it's starting up a ride for them, or whatever use case they had. That's a fantastic experience.
I remember when we worked at Wedding Party, this is exactly the kind of thing we wanted. Essentially, if there was an email, like a marketing email or something that went out, we essentially wanted our users to be able to click a button and then accordingly go to the Play Store or the App Store, download the app. And essentially after the app is downloaded, because we already have some of that information via the intent, we wanted to be able to like pre-populate information, right? So it makes just the user experience so much more nicer. And the funny thing is this actually can be done. And there are like services that apparently do this. And the mechanism is essentially fingerprinting that call, right? Like it's actually like pretty fuzzy. Like in some ways they try to see, what was the last call that was made, and like if it's made within a time frame of like 10 seconds and you hit the Play Store and then the Play Store got this link and this things match up, like these attributes match up, it was the same device, the same model, the same version, they actually do a lot of fuzzy logic to sort of come up with that solution, right?
They definitely do, and you can use a service like Tune that does the fuzzy matching.
Right.
But if you could define that yourself pretty easily as well, at least on Android.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because the referrer ID, if you just had a URL encoded string, you could pass in the specific deep link that you cared about as the referrer ID, and then you could pull that out yourself without ever having to have any type of server integration.
Which is pretty cool, yeah. And on that happy note, thank you so much, Ty. This was like, some of this information is mind-blowing because it's just like a completely different side or aspect to what we're typically used to. This is great information. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this has been great.
Of course. It's a fun field to work in. It's a very interesting subset of overall Android development.
Absolutely. And if folks want to know more about this and they want to find a way to reach out to you, what's the best way that they can do that?
Follow me on Twitter at tsmith. I'm pretty active on there and I'm happy to take messages directly. My website is tysmith.me, where I have some information and further contact. And feel free to reach out to me there. And if you want to learn more about developer platform and potentially work in that space, my team's hiring as well.
Excellent. And Don, if folks want to reach out to you about your adventures with AIDL integration and other stuff, what's the best way to do that?
Best and fastest way is going to be to hit me on Twitter at Don Felker. What about you, Kaushik? How can the folks get a hold of you?
Kaushik Gopal on Twitter. Again, that's Twitter's like the way to go these days. definitely the fastest way to reach out to me. Alrighty. Thank you so much, folks. And thank you for listening. And we will catch you in the next episode.
Thanks, everyone.
See ya. That's it for the show, folks. Fragmented is hosted by Don Felker and me, Kaushik Gopal. We edit all of the Fragmented episodes ourselves. The amazing Sarah from Spec helps us with production assistance and wraps our final mix. Our theme music and ad music is produced by the cool cat, Alan Taylor. You can find more episodes of the show on Pocket Casts, Google Play Music, or any of the other great podcast players in town. Our website is fragmentedpodcast.com, and you can find the links to all the stuff we say on our website. Thank you all for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode.